This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's about 1,000 miles from Clearbrook, Minnesota, down to Cushing, Oklahoma. Measured another way, it's about $4 a barrel. There was a pipeline explosion in Clearbrook late yesterday. Cushing is where crude prices are set, and oil traders in between have been very, very jumpy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, online at kauffman.org, and by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is the 29th of November. It's a Thursday, and it is good to have you here. Of all the things the oil markets needed, a nudge toward more volatility is most definitely not one of them. But that is exactly what happened with that pipeline explosion yesterday. Two workers were killed, and a key route for Canadian crude into the Midwest was crippled. Marketplace's Bob Moon is here to put the pieces together for us. Hi, Bob.
Hello, Kai.
How close was this to being really, really bad?
Well, a lot of the experts that I spoke to today said we really dodged a bullet. You know it's significant when you're reading the news wires and experts as far away as Europe and Australia are weighing in on something that's going on in Minnesota. And the Bush administration is saying that it's ready to tap into the country's strategic petroleum reserve to help offset any loss of oil.
Yeah, Minnesota is not really the first place you think of when you think about oil coming into this country.
That's right. There is an oil pipeline that flows from Canada into the Midwest through Minnesota, and it accounts for roughly 15% of our imports. And the problem is that there's just about no slack for the few Midwest refineries that depend entirely on the oil that they get by pipeline. This also happens to be a time that refiners start to ramp up their production of winter-grade gasoline and heating oil. And it apparently doesn't matter how soon they can get this oil flowing again. We spoke to John Kilduff. He's an oil analyst at MF Global.
Because there's going to be some crude interruptions, obviously. Some of the refiners are likely to have to throttle back production for at least a couple of weeks till the system catches up and replenishes from the outage that we've had there today.
Connect the dots for me, though, because last I checked, oil prices are actually down.
That's right. Well, there's going to be an immediate effect on pump prices, yes, but the oil speculators seem to have decided that there's no long-term effect here. You know, if you want to know what's going on with oil prices, one of the places that the speculators watch is an out-of-the-way place in Oklahoma. It's called Cushing, where these traders buy their contracts for crude in New York. Mm-hmm. The oil gets delivered by pipeline to a big farm of oil storage tanks out there on the plains of Oklahoma. And early this year, those tanks were almost full, and that helped keep the price of oil down. Well, one of the reasons that prices climbed over the summer was that those oil reserves in Cushing were being depleted. The storage tanks were way, way down.
Yeah, but talk to me about actual consumer demand, though. I don't seem to recall a spike in that. I mean, it's been rising, but...
Well, when the price started rising, the speculators decided it was time to cash in. Here's what I was told today by one oil trader, Stephen Shork.
This is more of a financial play of traders, again, looking at the forward curve, and it just simply doesn't make any sense to hold on to your inventory. So the inventory is essentially out there. So it's not being sopped up by demand per se, but it's essentially being sopped up by an arbitrage opportunity to realize the quicker gains in the spot market.
Well, guess what? Earlier this week, there was word the tanks around Cushing, Oklahoma, have been filling up again, ever so slightly, but oil analyst James Ritterbush told me that that's been enough to start pushing prices down.
What's more important to the market is the dynamic that the Cushing stocks appear to have bottomed, and they look to be in the initial stages of an upward trend. So that's what the market's going to be looking at.
Here's the thing, though, Kai. Oil from that crippled Canadian pipeline helps fill those tanks in Cushing.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to have to watch closely to make sure that they keep filling up and they don't get drawn down by these refineries that need the oil.
Oil goes up, it goes down. We get Bob Moon to tell us why. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Guy.
Wall Street slid sideways today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A couple of items now to get us into the rest of the day's news. The Commerce Department reported this morning the economy grew almost 5% July through September. The third quarter, of course, was before the worst of the subprime crisis hit. Also, today we learned home prices are still plummeting. Last month, they took their biggest percentage drop in almost 40 years, back to 1970 is the number. Amid all of that, Wall Street is hanging on by its fingernails, and corporate earnings are walking even more of a tightrope. Sears announced today profits were down 99%. Marketplace's Janet Babin fills us in from North Carolina Public Radio.
Sears blamed its earnings freefall on a warm October that depressed winter wear sales. Increased competition didn't help either, but the company admitted it has a lot to improve on. Several chains expect same-store sales to be weak over the holidays, but Milken Institute fellow Jim Barth says not every company's in the same boat as Sears.
Nordstrom's is positive. Walmart's positive. Radio Shack, you can get Eastman Kodak, Goodyear, Amazon, and all their earnings are up.
Their numbers might be behind the market's recent exuberance. Economist Mark Zandi, though, is not so sure. He says investor hopes that the Federal Reserve might lower interest rates again pushed shares up yesterday. But Zandi calls the recent uptick a relief rally that won't last.
There'll be days when the market does well, but I think there'll be more bad days than good over the next couple weeks, few months. The economy is struggling. Profits are now beginning to fall, and I think stock prices are going to reflect that.
Zandi thinks a recession's likely next year. And he says if it does happen, most of us would feel it. Unless we're really rich, our salaries would stagnate and so would our spending power. But many economists are a lot more bullish. Milken's Jim Barth says just talking doom and gloom about the markets can be a self-fulfilling prophecy.
It does no good to always see the negative sides of things.
Barth says the job market's steady and the export market is up 20% in the third quarter. Both bright spots that could keep the economy going. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Yesterday, we mentioned a speech Fed Vice Chairman Donald Cohen had given. It was the one we told you about that sent Wall Street spiking on hopes of a rate cut. Well, one of the other things that Cohen said was that the Fed's worried the credit crisis might spread beyond Wall Street. That brings us to Florida today. The state has shut off withdrawals from a fund school districts and local governments tap into. Officials say the liquidity squeeze means there's no way to value the assets that are in that fund. And on top of that, state and local governments elsewhere say they are having trouble finding investors for low-interest municipal bonds. That, in turn, could lead to taxpayers paying higher rates to build and maintain local infrastructure. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
We won't know for sure until overall statistics come out in a couple weeks. But anecdotally, November is shaping up as a bad month for tax-exempt municipal bonds, long considered safe investments. Both Miami and Chicago have canceled bond offerings totaling $1.5 billion. And Washington, D.C. is looking warily at plans for a $350 million bond for school and bridge renovations next week.
It has been a cause of some degree of concern.
D.C.'s treasurer, Lasana Mack, says he's not yet ready to postpone the bond issue.
We've been advised that we should be able to get our bond deal done and done successfully, so we're moving forward accordingly. However, you know, we are somewhat cautious given the dynamics going on in the marketplace.
What's happening is bond insurance companies, hit by subprime mortgage losses, can no longer backstop bond offerings from local governments. Also, banks are reining in their loans, especially this time of year as they try to clean up mortgage losses for their end-of-the-year accounting. Thompson Financial's Bob Nelson expects the current crunch to be short-lived.
We've never had an extended period of extreme duress in the municipal market. These types of situations tend to work themselves out in the sense that buyers eventually find the market so cheap that they come in, return the market to a more normal state, then the deals begin to flow again as buyers return, et cetera, et cetera.
If not, cities and local governments will have to offer investors higher returns to attract loans, which means more expensive borrowing for taxpayers. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
As the wider economy stalls, luxury goods and the people who sell them are feeling no pain. But Britain's World Wildlife Fund says there are no gold star performers among the biggest luxury brands. The conservation group ranked 10 of them and found they were C-minus students at best. Sarah Gardner reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
The UK's World Wildlife Fund ranked companies from Todd's to Tiffany on their environmental and ethical performance. The two highest scores were both French, cosmetics maker L'Oreal and purse and perfume purveyor Hermès, both rated a C+. Two Italian companies suffered the lowest grades. Both Bulgari and Todd's got big fat Fs. The fund's Anthony Cleanthus says aside from bad publicity over furs and so-called blood diamonds, the luxury world has gotten off light.
I just don't think that they have been publicly held to account in the past. And yes, I think they're rather surprised by it.
The company's rankings, however, were based in part on whether they responded fully to research queries, as well as news stories, and whether the companies reported their greenhouse gas emissions. The World Wildlife Fund in the U.S. distanced itself from the report, saying the methodology had flaws. But Milton Pedraza, CEO of the research firm The Luxury Institute, says his surveys show 57% of wealthy consumers say they care about corporate social responsibility.
So while obviously, the quality of the product and the prestige of the product are still extremely important, social responsibility on the part of these luxury providers is becoming very, very important to their constituents.
Anthony Cleanthus suggests that the stars who endorse low-scoring luxury brands need to ask these companies some hard-hitting questions. After all, he says, these days, every celebrity's got a cause. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
There are villains aplenty in the subprime mortgage mess. You've got lenders that didn't tell borrowers exactly what the terms of their loans were, homeowners who arguably should have known better, big Wall Street banks that got greedy at the prospect of easy money, and the big ratings agencies, Fitch, Moody's, and Standard & Poor's. They've been criticized for glossing over the risks that were piling up in the credit markets. Earlier this week, former SEC Chairman Arthur Levitt said those companies were plagued by conflicts of interest. But one ratings firm would welcome a shakeup. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
In the courtyard of New York's World Financial Center, Sean Egan nibbles on a treat from a pastry shop called Financier. He looks like a man on the brink of something. He's applied to get his company, Egan Jones, membership to an exclusive club, the one for ratings agencies approved by the Securities and Exchange Commission. Egan's been trying to get in for 10 years.
We spend time doing other things also.
There are just three main members of the club, Fitch, Moody's, and Standard & Poor's. Like them, Egan Jones checks the creditworthiness of a company's bonds and grades them for investors. But Egan Jones charges investors for its ratings. The big three agencies are paid by the companies they rate. Egan says that's a clear conflict of interest.
We believe that the interest of investors and issuers are diametrically opposed. The issuers in general want the highest rating possible, whereas the investors want an accurate rating.
Egan and plenty of others say that conflict has prevented Fitch, Moody's, and S&P from doing their jobs. They failed to catch the collapse of Enron, WorldCom, and more recently, mortgage-backed bonds until it was too late. Now investors are crying out for an alternative. Sean Egan says business is already picking up.
With the Enron and WorldCom, we were oftentimes a lone voice raising these concerns. Now it seems that people throughout the whole financial sector are addressing these problems.
But when it comes to using ratings, many large investors' hands are tied. Pension funds, banks, and insurance companies can only buy debt that's been rated by a nationally recognized statistical rating organization, NRSRO for short. The Securities and Exchange Commission awards that seal of approval. Until just a few years ago, the only NRSROs were, you guessed it, Standard & Poor's, Moody's, and Fitch. Joseph Mason teaches finance at Drexel University.
NRSRO status is the keys to the kingdom. Clearly, Egan Jones and firms that don't have NRSRO status are locked out of this special world and certainly cannot compete.
That's starting to change. Last year, Congress passed legislation to make it easier for firms to acquire the designation. An SEC spokesman says assuming all the paperwork is in order, Egan Jones should finally get approved. But Josh Rosner, with research firm Graham Fisher, says Egan Jones has its own conflicts. He says the firm may be free from issuer pressure, but Rosner says investors have their own reasons for persuading agencies to give good ratings. Downgrades can mean big losses for them, too.
If you're one of the very largest holders of a security, the last thing you want is an analyst to actually, you know, have a negative view or downgrade it. Where you can put a little bit of pressure or help the analyst think about the value of rethinking their views, you might well do that.
Rosner sees other problems with the industry. The rating agencies are protected by free speech laws, so they're not accountable for their opinions, and they're under no obligation to question whatever a debt issuer says about its operations. Rosner says bringing in new blood like Egan Jones is a good start, but he says regulators may have to intervene to restore faith in the system. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up, Inside the Matrix with eBay's CEO.
It's obviously an ecosystem. Buyers bring more sellers, who in turn bring more buyers, who in turn bring more sellers.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials closed up 0.1%, 22 points to end the day at 13,311. The NASDAQ moved up 0.2%, 5 points to finish at 2668. The S&P 500 traded flat at 1469. Dell reported strong third quarter earnings after the bell. Shares of the number two global PC maker rose 1.625% before the close. It was a bright, bright day for solar-powered stocks. First Solar Inc. heated up more than 10% today. TiVo's quarterly losses were lower than expected. It recorded a nearly 25% gain, if you can believe that. Bond prices were higher. The yield on the 10-year T-note ended the day at 3.93%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Conversations from the Corner Office, Dialogues with Top CEOs, is supported by Society for Human Resource Management. Online at shrm.org. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for October. President Bush is in Mount Airy, Maryland for World AIDS Day events. And now is your chance to get Ozzy's pants. Heavy metal rocker Ozzy Osbourne and wife Sharon are scaling back, selling stuff at a two-day auction in Beverly Hills, including the reality TV star's leather pants. Sales could generate about $1 million. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
The boss will see you now.
Today on Conversations from the Corner Office, a trip to San Jose, California, and the headquarters of eBay.
The online commerce company has been a powerhouse for more than a decade now. Today, it's got big-name subsidiaries like PayPal and StubHub. But growth in its core business, those auctions that made it famous, has slowed the past couple of years. So CEO Meg Whitman has been trying to make the site more user-friendly. I asked her about that when we talked on Tuesday.
Well, I think, you know, let's step all the way back. Of the thousands and thousands and thousands of companies that were founded on the Internet since 1995, there's only two with market caps of more than $45 billion. That's eBay and Google. Google is a lot more than $45 billion.
Let's take the shorter-term perspective, and let me ask you why, in the last couple of years, growth in your core business, that is auctions, has slowed.
Well, first of all, it's getting to be a very big business. You know, this year our users will trade over $55 billion worth of product. If we were a retailer, which of course we're not, we'd probably be in the top 10 retailers in the world. And then I think, you know, the standards on the Internet, the competition on the Internet, you know, has all changed quite a bit in the last two or three years. And we have to, you know, continue to keep pace with what consumers want and what our buyers want and what our sellers want. In this business, you have to constantly reinvent yourself.
One of the things you're doing to try to sort of reinvigorate growth around here is to turn eBay from what had been sort of a seller-focused marketplace to more of an emphasis on the buyer and making sure their experience is good and worthwhile. As we were preparing for this interview, we went around actually and talked to some people who do buying and selling on eBay, some people who have been doing it for a long, long time. One of them is a guy named John O'Neill, and we asked him this question about the balance between buyers and sellers. Here's what he said.
They spend too much time messing with the system. They need to find a happy medium. Don't make it for the buyer. Don't make it for the seller, because it takes both of them. It
takes two to tango, right?
Well, we started, obviously, really focused around the buyers, right? Because what we believed to be true was that, first and foremost, you have to have the buyers be happy, because if you have no buyers, you don't have sellers. But it's obviously an ecosystem. Buyers bring more sellers, who in turn bring more buyers, who in turn bring more sellers. And I would say in the last 3 or 4 years, we've become a little more seller-focused. And then last year, we said, you know what, we've got to really redouble our efforts back towards buyers.
There are, though, a million places out there on the web where I can go and buy something, whether it's doing a search on Google or whether it's going to Amazon. What makes you better?
You know what? It's really fun. The auction is fun. The community is fun. And people tell us all the time it is the most fun place for people to shop.
There is also a very strong, or has been in the past, I actually don't know if it's as strong as it used to be, a sense of community here at eBay that really was the basis for a lot of your growth. The last piece of tape I want to play for you is a guy by the name of Jay Sinise.
I know Jay.
See, there you go. So I don't need to identify him too much further other than to say he's a power seller. I mean, he makes a lot of money buying and selling on eBay. And we asked him the question of community and how you guys are stacking up in what is a very different environment than when you first started business.
I think the whole subculture thing at eBay has come and gone. A lot of people have burned out on eBay. They lost the community to places like MySpace and Facebook and the other, you know, chat sites and all that. The activity you see now on the message boards and the chat rooms is a shadow of what it was a few years ago.
Who's your competition in that regard, talking about this sense of community?
So, you know, it's interesting because this is community that is anchored in commerce. Mm-hmm. It's not just community for community's sake.
Right.
So we still are very much the community anchored in commerce model, whether you want to call it social commerce or whatever. And actually, the metrics continue to grow dramatically. We look at page views on our bulletin boards. We look at the number of messages that are going back and forth. And the community at eBay is still very much alive and well. Now, the question then becomes, what about where are people spending their time on the net? And it's very true that the 18 to 24-year-olds have been captured by Facebook and MySpace. We don't see a lot of our older customers, frankly, hanging out on MySpace and Facebook. But you know what? We have to keep pace with community. We have to think about ways to build community on eBay and then actually take eBay to those pages.
Do you find your demographic skewing older as time goes by?
They have always skewed a little older, even back to 1998, because you might recall collectors were the first to come, and collectors tend to be a little older. So we have a huge share of, you know, people basically over 30, and we don't don't have as big a share of sort of the 18 to 24-year-old crowd. And so we're working on how do we actually engage the younger group. But frankly, from an economic point of view, the purchasing power is, you know, the 28 and above.
When you bid on an eBay auction, are you one of those snipers who comes in at the last minute, or do you sort of, you know, place your bid and hope it all works out?
I do proxy bidding, which is where I say, here's the most amount I'm willing to pay, and then I let the system bid for me. And sometimes I win, and sometimes I don't.
What's the last thing you bought? You remember?
Yeah. Not a very glamorous item.
That's all right.
But when I travel, I tend to leave electronics, and I left my iPod charger in some hotel someplace. And so I went on eBay and found a great replacement for $9.95.
Meg Whitman, president and CEO of eBay, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks. Nice to see you.
There is more of my talk with Meg Whitman and conversations from other corner offices on our website. It's marketplace.org. You heard Meg Whitman say a minute ago that eBay is all about social commerce, that it's a business and a community. For a company like Facebook, the community is the business. Commentator Andreas Klute says before long, we'll all be social networking, just maybe not on Facebook.
Social networks are this year's next big thing. Facebook is so hot that it's theoretically valued at $15 billion. Why? Because it has allegedly reinvented something huge, the way human beings interact in their social cliques and circles. Well, true or false? Partly true, because technology is certainly enhancing, and sometimes complicating, our real offline social behavior. So, for example, it will soon be completely normal for a group of new moms to create their own social network, to blog about pediatricians, share info about this week's playgroup, upload videos of the toddlers, and so on. They can already do all that, but it will get easier and easier. But now for the false. Because people in the future will not log on to one particular website, which presents itself as their walled garden for all their social activities. They are doing that now in 2007, but that's because social networking is today where the internet was before the World Wide Web came along in the early 90s. Back then, we went to AOL. But once we started browsing the web, we were all just, well, on the web. The same exact thing will happen in networking. It will become not a site, not a destination, not a product, not even a company, but a feature. Your address book will talk to your calendar and your photo album and your blog, and then all those things will talk to the address books of the people in your address book. If one mom schedules a playgroup next Tuesday, it automatically shows up in your calendar too. Where and how does it show up? It doesn't matter. Because social networking will be a feature of every existing product by the big internet companies today, just like email. There's no email company either. Social networking is the new email. It's not a fad, and it's here to stay. And it's way too cool to be a business.
Andreas Klute is the San Francisco correspondent for The Economist magazine. Take a second to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, if you have ever come up dry looking for a loo in London, you are not alone. Westminster, home of the Abbey, is one of London's most popular tourist destinations. It's also apparently a tough place to find a lavatory, so local officials have launched a cell phone service to direct the desperate to the nearest bathroom. The service started today. It's called SatLav. It costs 50 cents and consists of a text message that pinpoints the nearest restroom. It works by gauging the strength of the phone signal, I'm told. Also, I guess, brings a whole new meaning to the word nature calls now, doesn't it? And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lifted 22 points, 0.1%. The NASDAQ skated up 5 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 was basically flat. Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, Product Lines for Moms focus on the scarcest resource, free time.
Between nursing and pumping and diaper changes and laundry, you have no time. You have maybe, if you're lucky, 5 minutes.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.